Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Guillermo Amaral joins me. We're not going to be talking about something. We're going to be talking to something. We're going to be talking to satellites with our software from the ground. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Guillermo Amaral. Episode 341, recorded June 17th, 2015. Satnogs. This episode is brought to you by DigitalOcean, simple and fast cloud hosting built for developers. Develop an SSD cloud server in 55 seconds. Try it today for free. Visit DigitalOcean.com, and once you sign up, be sure to enter the promo code FLOSS in the billing section for a $10 credit. And by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for the right payments API, check out the Braintree V.0 SDK. With one simple integration, you get every way to pay. To learn more and to try out the sandbox, go to BraintreePayments.com/floss. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, projects you may be using every day and not aware of it, projects you may want to download right after this show because something really cool inspired you to do something else. And you can tell this isn't reading this copy because I always flub up somewhere in the middle of this. Let me go ahead and bring on my co-host, Guillermo Amaral. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Randall. How's it going?
It's going well. And where are you speaking to us from?
Still in my secret Tijuana bunker here. As you can see, okay. It's a little messy this time, but it's still good.
Well, that's because you're a maker. You're always like tweaking on things, right?
Yeah, you know.
Which is going to be especially appropriate for this show. I should probably say that for those that recognize the green tree behind me, yes, in fact, I'm back at ZipRecruiter headquarters this week, or at least today. Well, at least this morning, I'm heading back over to the other headquarters a little bit in the afternoon. That's in Santa Monica, so lovely June gloom weather here, which is really kind of ugly. But the show's not about where we're speaking from. It's about our guests and the projects they represent. This week, no exception. We have representing the, I don't know how to pronounce this, but we'll just go Satnogs project, see if I can get his name right there. Pieros Papadeus is going to be speaking to us in a few minutes about Satnogs. What do you know about this so far?
I didn't really know much about it until we scheduled the show. I started looking into it and seeing something I personally think is super interesting. I never knew you could actually talk to privately owned satellites on the sky. And, you know, it's a little weird for me, but yeah, it's super interesting.
Let's back that up and get more context. So what this is some open source software and a bunch of hardware maker stuff. You know, that's all hardware is beyond me. So I'm hoping you're going to pick up on a lot of this stuff and help me out. But as open source software and hardware to actually talk to low Earth orbit satellites. So there's a bunch of those things up there now. Some of them are commercial operations. Some of them are amateurs, have managed to get piggyback launches on some of the recent trips upstairs. And this is the ground stations that can talk to those low Earth orbiting satellites. Also, I see there's even an opportunity to talk to high weather balloons. So if you have high altitude balloons, I'm supposed to be dangerous. Oh, in comes a hurricane. No. High altitude balloons and using Satnogs to talk to that. And it's like a whole network where you're like, you've got all these ground stations, you have to coordinate who has the radio time and all those, and how do you send information in and out for all that. And it sounds really fascinating, but it's a really out of this world project. I think the last time I got this excited about actually talking to people about things is when we did the Mars rover drivers back about, God, it was like 7 years ago, 6 years ago. So this looks pretty good from that perspective. Anything else you want to add there, Guillermo?
Well, maybe just point out that it is literally a not of this world project.
Yeah, I think that's what I was aiming for. All right. Well, we're going to get started in just a second, but I have a very important message I need to bring you before we get into the body of the show. Whether you're an experienced code warrior or just getting started, you need flexible, reliable, and affordable hosting. DigitalOcean provides developers with Droplets, which are virtual private servers that can be customized and deployed quickly to host websites, web apps, production applications, personal projects, virtual desktops, and almost anything else you can think of with full root access.
I myself am a customer of DigitalOcean. I found out about them back in at Scale back about, was it about 3 months ago? And they were giving away free coupons to be able to get some time with that. And they actually said, well, you can deploy an entire server in 55 seconds. And you know what? It was true. I filled in all my billing information. Then 55 seconds later, I had a free BSD box running in the cloud, running on SSD hard drive. Really, really fast. I use it as my build box now when I want to build packages for my other more traditional server. So DigitalOcean is built for developers and used by over 400,000 of them, including me. You can choose your OS, Ubuntu, CentOS, Debian, Fedora, CoreOS, and FreeBSD. FreeBSD is mine. And a one-click install allows you to develop apps like Django, Docker, Drupal, LAMP, GitLab, MediaWiki, Node.js, WordPress, Ghost, Magento, OwnCloud, Ruby on Rails, and more. And the servers can have up to 20 CPUs, 64 gigs of RAM, and 640 gigs of SSD hard drive space. It's all SSD. It's all really fast. Highly scalable to meet the demands of a rapidly growing application or business. And there's web console access with HTML5. Plus, you get SSH access, SFTP, KVM, and VNC for virtual desktops. And it's so easy to get started. You can deploy an SSD cloud server in as little as 55 seconds. I verify that. So DigitalOcean has incredibly affordable and straightforward pricing. Servers start out at only $5 a month. Where are you going to find a deal like that? $5 a month. There's also hourly pricing available starting at less than a penny an hour. But we're going to make it so you can get started today and deploy an SSD cloud server for free. Visit DigitalOcean.com and create an account. Once you confirm your email account information, go to the billing section and enter the promo code FLOSS, F-L-O-S-S, for a free $10 credit. That'd be 2 months for free for the $5 machine. That's plenty to get started and explore what DigitalOcean can do. That's DigitalOcean.com. And once you sign up, enter the code F-L-O-S-S in the billing section for a $10 credit. We thank DigitalOcean for their sponsorship of Floss Weekly. And now let's go ahead and bring on our guest, Pieros Papadias. Welcome to the show.
Hey. Hey, Randall. Hey, Guillermo. Thanks for having me.
And where are you speaking to us from?
Frankfurt, Germany.
Very cool. Very cool. So we got a sort of a, well, two-continent show. Sometimes we have more than two continents. I guess this will have to do. So I gave sort of the overview of what I think SatNogs is about, but why don't you give us, I guess, quite literally the 30,000-foot view.
Well, more than 30,000, but yeah, still. So SatNogs is a satellite network open ground station. And what we're building is a network of ground stations, which is the setup that lets you talk back and forth to satellites, and specifically low Earth orbit satellites. And we focus on that because the majority of satellites are actually low Earth orbit ones. In contrast with what many people think about satellites, which is geostationary, the ones that we use mainly for TV and media streaming and everything else. So we're not talking about geostationary ones, we're talking about the low Earth orbit ones. And SatNogs is creating a full stack of technologies, including the ground station, the antenna design, the receiving and transmitting, radio components, the embedded PC that runs on the ground station side, and then the network on top of that that coordinates all the different ground stations in order to provide scheduling and observation opportunities for multiple operators around the world.
Well, now, first off, you brought up a good point. These are not geostationary. So that means if I were to sort of be able to see this with magical eyes, it would actually be going across the sky. How long does it take to transit the sky?
Depends on the bus and depends on the satellite, but it would be a couple of minutes, up to 15 or 20 minutes. Still depends on the satellite, but definitely something which is moving, and that's why we need the rotator to actually follow the satellite across the sky. And once it's lost, we hope that we have enough ground stations around the world to actually follow the satellite after there is the loss of visual contact, basically.
Oh, okay. So you're talking about actually doing relaying so that as it goes from one ground station to another, you'd be able to maintain a continuous conversation?
Yeah. And we aspire to create a global network that can facilitate that 24/7 for all LEO satellites.
Okay, now these satellites are obviously there before you started this project. So how are people talking to them before?
So, first off, there was not necessarily a need to actually continuously talking to the satellite. But even when you have a satellite like this, before SatNogs, you would have a rotator which you could get commercially from various companies that are actually building rotators, set up your own ground station, and wait for the satellite to pass above you to actually get such a contact. What SatNogs is bringing on top of actually reconstructing the rotator using open source software and hardware. It's also the connectivity between the ground station, so the network piece of it.
And how long ago did Satnogs get started, and what triggered that?
So that's approximately a year now, and it was back in, well, more than a year. It was back in end of April last year, 2014. And we, as Hackerspace.gr, Hackerspace based out of Athens, Greece, we entered the NASA Space Apps Challenge, which is a yearly challenge, well, two-day event, with challenges, space challenges, that hackerspaces around the world are clustering around various projects and trying to provide solutions. And there was a specific project about developing a ground station, not necessarily a networked one. And we entered the NASA Space Apps Challenges. And during the weekend, we actually deployed the first version of a rotator. And after that, we actually wanted that to go bigger. And we thought, well, why, if you have a ground station, you don't actually connect multiple ground stations and create a global network? And that's how the Satnogs project actually was born.
That's awesome. Okay, so now you're able, or you will eventually be able to have conversations with these LEOs. What do you say to them? What can be accomplished by talking to these things?
So initially, we're focusing on receiving signals from LEO satellites, and most of the signals are beacons, like status beacons, basically, of the satellites, and also the scientific payloads, the data from the scientific payloads that those satellites have. Most of the LEO satellites lately are scientific projects through or commercial projects in CubeSats, and a CubeSat is a 10 by 10 by 10 centimeter, 1 kilo small satellite. And lately, we've been having hundreds of them out there every year. And most of them are experiments, scientific experiments, or it could be, you know, magnetospheric measurements. It could be Earth monitoring systems. It could be experiments about radio communications or payload capabilities. So all of those have to transmit their scientific data back, basically, the results of the experiment. And we are focusing on receiving those kinds of payloads.
So is this government-funded, university-funded, or private and amateur stuff setting these up?
So are you talking about Satnogs in specific, or are you talking about...
No, I'm talking about the LEO satellites. How are they getting up there?
Oh, so pretty much all of the categories you mentioned. So there are many lately commercial projects from for-profit companies. Traditionally, there have been many governmental agencies that have been sending satellites on LEO. There's also many academic projects that are going up there. So a combination of pretty much all of them.
Cool. Actually, we've got a picture of, I think, the very first Satnog base station got set up in Athens. For the people watching the video, they can see it, but most of us are listening on the audio. Can you describe what we're looking at here?
Yeah, so this is indeed the first ground station that went online, and this is on top of hackerspace.gr in Athens, Greece. And you can see one of the two antennas. Actually, the setup right now has two antennas. And you're looking at the helical antenna. This is the yellow small pieces together with the wire, the coil that goes like a helix. And this is on UHF band. That would be the 70 centimeter band for amateur radio communications. And the box that you see on the center, which is has the front cover missing because we're using it for specific services at that point. This is the rotator. This is the mechanical and electronics equipment that enables the antenna to point wherever it needs to be pointing on the hemisphere, on the sky, and it can go 180 degrees on the azimuth. And 0 to 90 degrees on the elevation. So you can capture pretty much all the satellite paths across the sky.
And how fast is that rotating to track? Well, you said about 2 minutes for a pass, possibly, so it might take, it might be moving pretty quickly. Does that cause any stability issues when you're having to move fast?
Well, a 2 minutes pass would be a super low one and not really useful for satellite communications. But for the average pass of the 8 to 10 minutes of usable time, you would get at peak, you would get something around 5 to 6 degrees per second. And this is still within the operational abilities of the Satnogs rotator.
You mentioned that the project also does a lot of open hardware. What part of the stack is actually open? Is it the base stations? Do you also do any, maybe some hardware for LEO satellites that somebody wants to maybe launch up into space?
So right now we're focusing on the ground station aspect of it, like the actual node that does the communication. So the open hardware pieces are, okay, I'm going to start with the antennas, which is the receiving part. So we design and construct the antennas ourselves and publish, of course, everything under an open hardware license. Also the duplexer, which is the way to combine two signals from different bands into one receiver. The mechanical assemblies, all that you see in the rotator, which is the gears, the worm gears, the shafts and the axis holders and everything else that you see inside the rotator are all released as open hardware with documentation on how to actually build those things. And right now we're also developing, we entered the ESA, the European Space Agency Summit of Code, and we have a student out of Spain that he's developing a low noise amplifier, so RF components, also under open hardware licenses.
For example, you mentioned the antenna bits of the base station. Are those getting milled by you, or and the gears in this example, are they 3D printed? Are you purchasing these from some local supplier?
So the way that we go about it is that we make sure that all the designs that we publish can be easily constructed by anyone that has access on basic tools and machinery, and especially on rapid prototyping tools like a 3D printer on your local hackerspace. So you can in practice construct everything from scratch by just having access on an average hackerspace, or if you have those things in your backyard, which would be awesome. As far as the kits and mailing and, you know, if we can supply some of those things, at this point we don't, but we are looking into, many people have been asking that actually, and we understand that not everyone has access on a local average hackerspace, so we also we're also right now exploring, starting September, to supply some kits for some basic things that people cannot find.
Well, you just answered my next question, actually. Yeah, I was wondering if you guys are supplying maybe kits to people who are interested in building this. Now, if I want to put one of these base stations here in my secret bunker, you know, it's not really under the ground, as you can probably tell. but if I want to put, let's say, a base station here, do I need any, you know, line of sight, any clearance, anything special, or maybe a mountain, or how would I choose a nice location for this?
So, two aspects of it. The first would be, yes, as much sky you can see, that's better for the ground station and the network, obviously. But at the same time, we recognize that not everyone has access to like really clear skies. So even if you have an obstacle like a big building or a giant mountain next to you, the software can actually accommodate for that. So while you're registering your ground station to the network, you can say that I don't have access on this part of the sky, and we can take that into account when we do scheduling, so that we know that we're not going to schedule to you a pass that goes through your obstacle. So not necessarily any specific requirements apart from network connection, because we need the data back once we capture them. As clear skies as possible.
All right. So in this case, my secret bunker is located near a beach. I'm not going to say which one. So usually here, you get a lot of overcast and you get a lot of clouds. That's not going to interfere with that at night, maybe?
Not necessarily. Not at all, I would say. So the clouds and rain are totally fine. The whole design is waterproof. But when we go to some kind of like extreme conditions, like high winds and snow and, you know, continuous ice, and if you go on the, you know, like extreme places, basically, then you would have to, like, the basic setup would not be appropriate. And for that, we actually developed a rad dome, which is a radio dome. You can think of it as a sphere that surrounds the whole ground station, and it holds it in, you know, a waterproof and airtight place, so that you don't get interference from weather elements.
Oh, that's good. So let's say you just mentioned we need some sort of a data connection for this. Can somebody just set up maybe a, like 3G connection? Can you do dial-up maybe, like if somebody still uses dial-up?
So the bandwidth that, well, a basic ADSL broadband connection would be enough. A 3G connection would actually be better in most cases around the world, judging from what we've seen on, landline broadband connections. Yeah, a dial-up would not be enough, especially when we are uploading the data back to the network. So depending on how many observations your ground station will get scheduled to do by the network, you're going to have a lot of information, a couple of hundred megabytes probably per day that you need to upload back to the network. So that would have to, we would have to take that into account when you're thinking about your network connection.
Oh, nice. So is there any let's say, any checks do you do? You do when you have maybe a base station that's located somewhere where you don't really have a stable connection? If you get drop-offs or if it gets disconnected, are you able to, on the software side, I suppose, are you able to maybe re-ask for the information? Or how would that work? How would the how would working throughout those connection issues work on your end?
So, again, two different aspects of this. The one would be that we are constantly monitoring the ground stations, whether they're pinging the network for next scheduled observations. So every 5 minutes, a ground station actually pings back the network and says, hey, do you have a job for me? Do you have a job for me? If there is a job scheduled for the ground station, then you receive all the appropriate information to run the job in some time in the future. So that's the aspect number one. And for that, if a ground station has not checked in for more than 3 hours, we're actually saying, well, 3 hours is the current setup. We might be changing that. But for some specific time, we say that, okay, this ground station is probably not available. We're sending an email to the ground station owner, and we're putting it off the ground station scheduling operations so that, you know, there is not an expectancy to get information out of this ground station. So that's the one part. And then the second part is that, let's say that, you know, you have like a 5 minute check, you get a scheduled observation to do on a ground station. The ground station embedded Linux platform actually performs the operation, but then once this data is captured, the network is not available, so it cannot be sent back. So we've accounted for that and said that we have a buffer, basically, like a disk space, which is allocated for storing locally observations. And that could be enough for 2 or 3 days to store this information, and those will become available when the network is back in and the data gets to be posted back on the network. If it's more than that, then...
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry, We actually have a question, which sounds like station in my brain, apparently. We actually have a question from POSAT in the chat room. I think you sort of covered this, but if you had one of those commercial trackers already available, could you run the rest of the software stack against the commercial hardware?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. We designed SatNOX from scratch to be completely modular, which means that you can eliminate any of our reference design, that being the rotator in this case, and work with a commercially available rotator, because we're using specific libraries and protocols that are commonly available to everyone, and most commercial rotators actually implement those. In this case, this is called Hamlib. It's a set of ways to communicate with rotators. And then, yes, you can not necessarily use a ground station reference design that we have, but you can use a commercial rotator and still be able to post back data to network and be part of the ground station network that we have.
And I'm also curious, you know, you said LEO satellites, but I'm thinking that the ISS qualifies as an LEO satellite. Is there any chance of getting data from there?
Yes, it does. And it actually hosts one of the most powerful transmitters up there. So it's an easy target, basically, for us. There are various different things that the ISS actually posts back. Most of them are relays of information. So you can use it. It's basically a transporter, and you use it, you talk to it from the ground, and then it relays this information back to the ground at some point else. And that can happen over voice or APRS, which is a data coded format for location, an encoding for location setting, and you can use ISS for that. Apart from that, ISS also operates its own amateur radio station, and you can listen to us, you know, at some point, scheduled or not, operations from astronauts on ISS that are talking back to the ground, and talk to them also.
Okay, and this is obviously a limited resource, and now we're going to shift it slightly here. So scheduling, how do you decide if two requests come in that both need the same ground station, who gets it?
So the requests about a specific satellite or different satellites? So let me rephrase that. The requests are coming in asynchronously, right? Not synchronously. So someone goes in and says, well, I would like to follow this satellite in this frequency for this specific time frame. And then once we present to this operator the chart, the timeline of the operations, including the ground stations and the different operations that each ground station will do. And if the operator is okay with it, then we schedule the operation. So this cannot really happen synchronously, right? Like it has to happen asynchronously. So it's a kind of like a first come, first serve type of scheduling at this point. But we're also looking on for some specific kind of ground stations that we know that are reliable in operation and that we have a focused project that we need to work on, setting aside some resources for some specific satellites to be available for those operators that need that. So kind of like overriding this scheduling algorithm.
Yeah, and especially like when you're actually transmitting rather than receiving, I imagine SatNogs isn't the only people that want to talk to a given satellite. So would you have to coordinate that with anybody else that might want to transmit at that time? And how do you do that?
Yeah, so transmitting is much more complicated also on the legal side of it. So not everyone with an amateur radio equipment or software-defined radio or a rotator like SatNogs or any commercial can actually transmit. So you need a license for that on most countries in the world. And even with a license, you actually need to be, you know, really specific on what you're going to use, how many watts you're going to be using, and, you know, all those legal issues that you have around it. So right now we're exploring the kind of like a user experience around transmitting, working in collaboration with CubeSat operators to check their needs and, you know, how they're going to be actually doing that. Because frankly speaking, up until now, most CubeSat operators, like the vast majority of CubeSat operators, have not been thinking about, okay, what would happen if we could speak to our satellite 24/7. So most of the CubeSat operators are tailored around, okay, we're going to see our satellite like twice a day, like three times a day at best. And yeah, at that point, like no one else would speak to that. And they don't also know what to say to the satellite, right? You need to know many things in order to actually transmit information to a satellite for commands and everything else. And there is also an authentication and security issue on that. So we're working with CubeSat operators to figure out how they're thinking about doing that in a 24/7 fashion, which is not still defined.
Wow, that's really amazing stuff. And I know Guillermo is really hot to ask the next question, but I want to go pay the bills for a second. So this episode is brought to you by Braintree, code for easy online payments. If you're building a mobile app and searching for simple payments solution, check out Braintree. The Braintree V.0 SDK makes it easy to offer multiple mobile payment types. Start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo, cards, and more, all with a single integration. Simple and secure payments, code you can integrate in minutes. Don't have time? Give them a call and they'll even handle the integration for you and walk you through it. SDKs in seven languages, .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, yay Perl, PHP, Python, and Ruby. Elegant code with clear documentation and only 10 lines of in-app code. Braintree gives you an easy way to accept multiple payment types in one integration. Quick, knowledgeable developer support if you have any questions. Start accepting Apple Pay, PayPal, Bitcoin, Venmo, cards, and whatever's next, all in a single integration. With the Braintree V.0 SDK, one small snippet of code and you're all set up in less than 10 minutes. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to BraintreePayments.com/floss. And we thank Braintree for their sponsorship of Floss. And now, Guillermo, I think you had something hot to ask.
Something hot to ask, Randall. We've been focusing on the hardware aspect of this for a little while. You mentioned embedded Linux a few minutes ago. Can you give us an idea of how the back end, the software for this works? What languages are you using? How exactly are you guys using embedded Linux and in what parts?
Yeah, so this is about the part that runs the actual ground station. So its ground station actually has an embedded PC, Linux run on it, that is next to the ground station. And on that, we have all the radio, software-defined radio that we use for RX and TX for receiving and transmitting signals. And we also use it to command an Arduino that is controlling the stepper or DC motors for the actual rotation of the rotator. Now, this runs on Linux, as I said, and specifically Debian at this point. We also used to have some experimentation around OpenWRT in order to trying to minimize the resources needed to run the embedded part of the client. But we're now focusing more on the Debian side of things. And the on top of the actual operating system, we have what we call the Satnox client, which is written completely in Python. Well, at least the vast majority of it. And the Python Satnox client makes sure to ping the network every once in a while, initiate all the different scheduling observations, run the capturing, run the recording of the and decoding if necessary of the signal, and posting back things on the network. And of course, everything is open source and available through our website.
Oh, nice. You mentioned you guys are using Linux and a little embedded system on the base stations, right? So in this case, are you using something easily available, maybe like a Raspberry Pi or maybe a dev board that's, you know, out there right now? Or are you building something custom?
So the Satnox client right now is tested to run on a Raspberry Pi, on a Big Blue Black, which is a reference design, on a Odroid C1, Odroid U3. So we're testing couple of different setups, and each one has the pros and the cons. But the reference design that we say to people, we suggest that people use, is a BigBlueButton Black right now.
Okay, so you are specifically telling them use this one since the other ones are maybe not that well tested right now.
Well, the old Raspberry Pi had their own issues, right? And the Raspberry Pi 2 actually solved them. So we are in a final experimentation phase to give a green light on Raspberry Pi 2, which would be great because it's more easily available to people. And also Odroid C1, it's a super powerful machine from Korea, and we are also suggesting that. So it's not really, you know, we have a reference design, that's for sure, but we're not saying to anyone, you know, like you cannot use an embedded PC that's out there. There are lots of different options.
Well, that's great. And are other people, you know, porting your system over to like new dev boards out there?
Yeah, so a couple of different community members have been trying that on a Humming board, on some old BeagleBones, even on a Panda board. And most of them seem to work really well. What's really an issue for us is how the USB connection is handled and the USB receptacles and the voltage is handled on the actual device, because we have been having some troubles with the software-defined radio module that we use on that. So that's why we're super careful on saying to everyone which is the device that, you know, they might be having a better luck on implementing a client. But many community members have been doing a fantastic job porting that and testing it out on many different dev boards.
Okay. You also mentioned using an Arduino to control the servos and gears on your base station, right? Are you really using like an official Arduino board, or are you using clones, or maybe are you guys thinking of maybe later on building your own little controller there?
So whenever you do this, it's always tempting to say, okay, I'm going to go with my own board, right? Like I'm going to do my own electronics. I'm going to release it open hardware, and it's going to be best for the usage. But as I said, like we're trying to keep things as modular as possible, so that people that have access to specific, you know, components and boards, like, can get started as easy as possible. So in this case, we're using an official Arduino Micro. And we have been playing also with some other cores, which are Arduino Micro derivatives, and anything that runs an Arduino code, basically, because that part of the code is written in wiring, then yes, it would be enough to drive the stepper drivers or the DC motors.
Okay, yeah, I was just making sure, since I know a lot of people mention when they're talking about like an Atmel micro, they just say Arduino to like wrap everything up in a nice little package. So it is one of, you know, an actually available board. People can just go and buy, in this case, a BeagleBone Black and a few motors and a Arduino board, and they could probably technically kind of get started with the electronics bits for this then?
Yeah, the only thing that would be missing is kind of like a motherboard. Like we have designed like a little receptacle basically for the Arduino Micro that also hosts the Pololu drivers for the stepper drivers. And that is not really a super complicated electronics board, and it's super cheap to either make it yourself or order it online.
How are you powering all these little gadgets? Are you using power over Ethernet maybe, since you're technically need to be connected to the base station somehow? Or do you have your own power supply there? Is it battery powered?
So we've actually have two different options. The one option, which is the permanent one, is powered over Ethernet, PoE. And we supply the 24 volts for the motors, and then we drop the voltage with the voltage regulator down to 5 volts for everything else in there. That would be the embedded PC and the software-defined radio, the low-noise amplifiers, and everything else that we have in the rotator. And that's kind of like the permanent option. And then we've been trying many mobile setups for not only satellite operations, but also high-altitude balloon operations, as Randall said before, using batteries out of just standard batteries of cars, or you know, everything that supplies approximately 13 volts, 12 to 14 volts, would be enough to drive an operation.
So if one of these base stations would be mobile, how are you syncing up the location? Are you guys do you guys have a GPS inside the base station?
Yeah, so we would actually not be super comfortable of having multiple mobile stations on the network, because it's kind of like tedious to you know, keep track and make sure the connection is right and everything else. The mobile operations is mostly for experimentation on different bands, different satellites, different setups, and on non-satellite operations like the high-altitude balloon ones. So we don't expect necessarily to have many mobile ground stations on the network.
Okay. Well, you did mention a community before when we talked about maybe porting the software for the embedded Linux onto a different boards. How big is the community now for development anyway?
Yeah. So, well, community definition, right? Like what you count as community can be many different things. So the core team would be like the people that are, you know, constantly contributing, testing out new things, writing code, designing parts and everything else, would be approximately 20 people right now around the world. And we have a community of beta testers and people that are building ground stations, which is in the rounds of hundreds right now. And we have a discourse forum that we're coordinating everything in there regarding our global community, which is under community.satnox.org.
And how about, go ahead.
Okay, I was just going to ask, so I think you said it already, but I was busy watching the chat room to make sure there weren't any more questions, but so how many actual deployments do you have so far? How many people are participating in the networks?
So we recently did a new release of the network, so some old experimentation deployments are not online anymore. So currently we do have a production deployment of 2 ground stations, and we have six ground stations that are like literally next week or the week after that, like coming online. So,
and what kinds of people are you looking at in terms of getting contributions? I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of different pieces here, a lot of moving parts, literally. So, what expertise would I need to be able to contribute to this? And should I have a particular background? Say, I see you're in amateur radio before you got into this. Is there some people that are more naturally attracted to this kind of thing?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, because the stack is kind of like large, so we're looking at a multitude of different skill set, basically for people to have. And it could be the primary focus right now has been radio amateur operators, because they have the expertise on the antenna setup. They also have some of the legal issues solved if there is a transmitting opportunity for experimentation. And they also, like, they're quite familiar with frequencies and, you know, all the setups around that. Now, Now, that being said, that's mainly on the operation of the ground station at this point. And moving forward, and actually quite recently, we've been having many people on the software side, which is just Python coders or infrastructure guys or people that are working with, you know, huge loads of data to trying to figure out what's happening in there. And also mechanical design. So the actual reference ground station design, how the gears fit together. So if someone has no idea about software, no idea about radio, but still is like really gear nerd or a mechanical nerd, then yeah, Satnox has a place for contributions, definitely for those things.
And so I'm more of a software guy. I'm curious about, say, the between the stations protocols, and is there a central server that these all are phoning into? What does the wire protocol look like? How are you doing that?
So the architecture of that is that we have a central server that we call the Satnox network on network.satnox.org. And that would be a Django-based Python web application that coordinates all the different ground stations around the world. There is an API that the ground stations get to poke in order to get any scheduled observations that they have per ground station. And then once this information is transmitted to, is retrieved from the client side from the network, then the client side actually makes the observation itself, records all the data, decodes it, and then pushes it back through the same API back to the network. So Django-based Python application running on a server that hosts all the data and coordinates the different observations.
And what database are you using? I think I know the answer.
Do you? Postgres.
Oh, you are? Oh, my God. Thank you. All right. Finally, a winner. Postgres. Lovely. I just hate people who do green starts with MySQL these days. So I'm always trying to see if I can get around that somehow. And what was, I mentioned slightly about your background, but what brought you to this project? How did you all of a sudden see something you wanted to play with?
So, well, it's not necessarily about myself in specific, but we've been, well, I also have been a radio amateur and amateur astronomer. So kind of like combining those two, the passion for space and the passion for technology and the passion for radio, you know, it's a natural fit to actually, you know, think about, you know, Satnox and join such a project and kickstart such a project together with like-minded people. So it was a combination of a love for space and a love for open source software and hardware and love for radio.
That sounds really awesome. Let's see. We've talked about the community. What's the roadmap for this? What are you missing right now that's most critical? And where do you see yourself going maybe in a couple of years?
So right now we're focusing on more and more ground stations. So the really what's going to make the difference from what's out there in terms of satellite communications is a global network, as global as it can get. We're talking about hundreds of ground stations as soon as we can get them, and multiple members in the community that can experiment with us, contribute back to the project, and create new ideas around satellite communications, and specifically this platform that we're building, Satnox. So the next big push is basically around that, getting a ground station in any part of the world. That's the main push for Satnox per se. And in the next couple of years, like, we would like to see Satnox actually be the default option for any satellite operator that would like to talk to their satellites back and forth, and have Satnox be the standard for satellite communications on LEO.
And Let me just think about cost for a second. I mean, let's say I've got a backyard and I've got a good internet connection and I've got a clear view of the sky. What are these ground stations going to set me back if I just wanted to say, yeah, I'll be a ground station. Tell me what to do.
So it depends on the specifics of the setup, but everything is around the ballpark of like $400, $400 to $500. Depends on some of the radio setup, but that's kind of like the top for it.
Cool, cool. And I'm just thinking now, when you're talking about hundreds of phone homes back to your central server, how are you envisioning being able to scale what you're doing in the central office?
Yeah, so this is a question about data scaling at some point. And we've been having the help from GRNet, which is an academic research network in Greece, regarding their facilities in terms of infrastructure to be able to scale more on the data side. So there are some good options about that. And it all depends on the actual user experience that we want to provide to the operators. And one of the biggest problems that we're going to face anytime soon, hopefully, is the data retention and how much back we can have live data on the network. We're talking about terabytes of information, and we're thinking about cold storage options. You know, what happens when someone wants to request like an operation like for 3 years back, and how we're going to be dealing with that. So it's an exciting actually opportunity for us to dig into that and be able to work with fantastic people around our community to find a solution on that.
You mentioned a few minutes ago, actually, that you want to have base stations everywhere, right? So how would that work? There's some really specific places in the world that might be a little bit too extreme. Let's say maybe the desert, the Mojave Desert, the Atlantic or ocean, maybe like a little buoy there. Or how would this kind of work for those places?
So... one point about the global coverage, we've been doing some calculations, and those are some initial results that we'll be getting, is that we need approximately, and don't quote me on that, but something around 1,000, every one ground station every 1,000 kilometers. And I'm sorry, that I don't know how that is in miles and everything else. That would be something that we cannot necessarily have in almost all places around the world. I think that we have a coverage of something around 93 to 95% of the globe that has a spot that we can put, in theory, a ground station. But of course, there are much more difficult logistical stuff to solve around that. So let's say if there is an island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, just because there is an island, that doesn't mean that we can have a ground station there, right? That there like network connectivity, who's going to maintain it, what's the access to that island and everything else that we need to solve. But we are aspiring to find solutions around this as we grow, especially as we have more community around us to help us on that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, in fact, you just answered one of my questions. I was wondering how would you be able to connect this if you maybe stick one in the middle of the ocean, maybe an island or in an oil rig. I suppose the oil rig might have some sort of internet connection now. You know, it's the future already. So one question though. What else could you do with one of these base stations? Let's say you already have it set up in your backyard. Maybe it's not, maybe in the area you are, it's not really getting that much use. Could you do something else with the base station?
Yeah, so if you think about it, what Satnox is a rotator that can point wherever in the sky, and also it has a radio receiving subsystem. So in theory, you can play around with scientific concepts like radio astronomy, which is something that we've been actively exploring together with some radio astronomers that have been joining our community. So interferometry, baseline interferometry, like possibly in the future, there are of course some technical issues to solve around that. Radio astronomy is one of the strong things that we're thinking as an alternative to satellite operations for the SatNOGS ground station.
How legal is this, though? Are you just able to listen in on any communication from any LEO satellite, going through the globe, or do you need to ask permission from the operators?
So depends on the country and depends on the legislation and what kind of license the operator actually has or not, or to what extent can someone waive their right on this equipment and give it to someone else that has a license in order to be the forefront basically of capturing this information. Surprisingly, one of the things that is really good about having an open source community, we do have some legal contributors in SatNOGS. So there's a team of three people right now working around the clock, literally, on some aspects, to figure out some legal technicalities around the world and how we can operate within our legal boundaries so that we could not cause any issues to the satellite, to the ground station operators.
Yeah, in fact, you just answered my other question. You're really good at this. Yeah, because, I could imagine if I set up one of these stations in, let's say, in my house, and somebody uses it to listen in on a LEO satellite that is probably private, and they don't want to share that information with anybody. Would that make me legally liable? I suppose
liable.
Yeah, liable. Would that make me liable? I that's one of the questions that maybe people need to start you know, thinking about, since I have no control over what the my base station would really be pointing at, right?
Yeah, so the main concern legally would not actually be the satellites themselves, because for those satellites that the satellite operators and the satellite owners would not like you to listen to the signals, those signals are encrypted or they're activated upon request and everything else. So everything else that is out there in terms of satellite communications, you can legally capture it. There are some treaties, some outer space treaties and some space treaties between countries around those things. But a rule of thumb would be that everything that is transmitted and you can read it on radio amateur frequencies, that would be the 2 meter band, 70 centimeter band, 23 centimeter band and upper than that, then you're totally okay legally to actually receive and decode and supply this information back to the public.
Okay, so I guess it works kind of like taking photographs outside, right? It's already, everything's out there, and if you're just listening in on it, it's not that bad. I can kind of get an idea for that. What are your plans, let's say, for the next 5 years? Are you planning on making bigger, better base stations?
Yeah, once again, focusing on the globality of it, but also the nonprofit behind Satnox, which is the Libre Space Foundation. That's the nonprofit that we set up to support Satnox, basically. We're focusing more on how we can get the space industry, which is right now in a huge explosion, and everything is, you know, like promising, and there are many more people working towards space technologies nowadays. We would like to see more and more technologies shifted towards open source software and open source hardware in the Libre way that we feel about and our mission feels about. So focusing more on top of establishing a solid network of Satnox ground stations, actually impacting the technologies that are out there in terms of CubeSat design, satellite communications, what we do on space experiments, satellite design and everything else, and trying to shift that towards open source software and open source hardware.
You know, we touched on this a couple times, but I want to make sure we really cover this particular aspect of it. You said, we said towards at the beginning of the show, I said at the beginning of the show, that you're actually tracking high altitude high altitude balloons. I did it again. First it was high weather balloons, which don't make any sense at all. Send it up in a tornado. No. Can you talk more about how Satnox contributed to this project where they sent up a balloon and were able to track that?
Yeah, so balloons generally, not all of them, but a lot, actually sent back a beacon, an APRS beacon, which is the position that the balloon is right now. And this is really useful for retrieval of the balloon, but not necessarily the operators of the balloon, the people that actually launched the balloon, not necessarily can track the balloon across the sky with omnidirectional antennas. So what we're using Satnox for is to have directional pointing of the antennas towards the balloon using supplied APRS beacons, and then predicting the next possible location of the balloon when the next beacon would come, and also course correcting along the way. So that supplies us with a continuous tracking of the balloon, and especially the most important part, like finding the last beacons just before it hits the ground, so that the balloon retrieval teams can actually go there and find the payload. That's a key concept of high altitude ballooning, that you have to retrieve the payload back. So Satnox can be really helpful pointing directionally the antennas towards that that spot and getting the final payloads for the location.
So let me understand this. So you're saying APRS, and I don't even know what that means, but that's okay. I'll just make it up. And so it's constantly sending out a signal in all directions saying, I am at this altitude and this particular GPS coordinates, and you're trying to receive that, but obviously you've got to be pointed at it to receive that. How much off-axis error can you have before you start losing the thing entirely?
Well, it depends on the antenna that you're using, but it could be something around like 15 to 20 degrees
For
the directional Yagi antenna.
I was thinking it had to be like within 2 or 3 degrees, and I was going, well, you know, if you ever miss it, it's like, well, now where is it? Do you have hunting algorithms that can kind of listen all in a patch of the sky to try to find something?
So right now we're not doing an active scanning of the sky. What we're doing is that we're getting the final two positions from the APRS, and we are extrapolating the next position, the next possible position for balloon. Once this happens, then we are course correcting, you know, for the next position using the previous two. So yeah, kind of like predictive position algorithm.
Yeah,
really
cool,
simple.
Cool.
Not as, you know, as it sounds complicated, but it's a super simple one.
Well, you keep it simple first until you figure out something like that doesn't work under these conditions. Then you start applying patches, and that's how we end up with everything we got today. So, yes, it's software is organic. Software grows according to fitting the needs. Well, we're almost out of time. I think I could probably talk with you for another half hour, but we do have a hard limit here on the network. So is there any question I didn't ask, or we, Guillermo and I didn't ask, that you really want to make sure our audience is aware of?
I think that you asked fantastic set of questions, and I think that you got
very good. Very good. And I got to ask my two required questions, or again, my audience emails me and tells me that I forgot to ask the questions. What's your favorite scripting language?
That would be JavaScript.
JavaScript. Okay, well, that's a good answer. That's a different answer than Python. Thank you. And your favorite text editor?
That would be lately Atom.
Atom? Is that a, what is that? Is that a like a Windows thing? No.
No. That's a a GitHub project, open source project. It's an editor. It's a GUI. I know I suck on GUIs and everything, but
okay.
Originally, that would be Vim. So okay.
You hear you were being really good, say Adam, and then I wasn't going to get around to opening that we were not going to say Vim. Okay. Well, I guess I'm the old guy here because I'm still Perl and Emacs, but that's life for me. Fascinating show. I'm glad you were able to come on and talk about SatNOGS. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Very good, very good. And that was Piros Papadeus talking to us about SatNOGS. What do you think, Amaral? I'm just going to leave out your first letter now.
That's fine. Don't worry. It's Gamaral. That's fine. I have this new great idea for Kickstarter now. We can actually maybe build a little satellite called Laporte. We can maybe have it, you know, stream down Twit videos. And then we could technically have a Leo Laporte up in the sky. Just an idea. This is actually super interesting. I really like the both the hardware electronics aspect, the embedded Linux aspect, of course, and you know, the networking part, the database part. It's okay, you know, it's okay. That's fine. I would have probably used MariaDB.
But you know what's nice about this, though, is it sounds like a great way, especially when you have a rich maker community in an area, it sounds like a great way to bring together those that want to be hardware tinkerers and those that want to be software tinkerers. And you know, because I could get excited by the software side. I mean, you heard me ask a couple questions about scaling. I'm always interested in how people scale, and because most of my clients have done it really poorly, and that's why they bring me in to make things go faster. When they don't have 50 jobs, they have 50,000 jobs and then 500,000 jobs. Now what do you do for the next thing to happen? So this is really, really, really cool. So I'm excited by it. It's great that you can have end-to-end something that, you know, because the balloon was sent out by radio amateurs as well. So it's like you've got people, not government, not industry, not university, but you've got, you know, private individuals collectively getting together and doing something way up in the sky and tracking it and getting data from it. It's pretty exciting, actually. You know, it shows that it isn't just the government's role to do this anymore. So I'm pretty happy with all that. Anything else before we move on?
No, not really. I'm just really actually interested in checking out the software for this. I'm not sure if we mentioned what, if it was in C, C++ or something. I do know he mentioned a little Python in there. Yeah.
That's Python, okay. Mostly. That's okay. There are plenty of Python programmers. Other people can do that part of the coding. I might help with, say, the network protocol or something that we could scale pretty nicely. All right, let's move on. We're almost out of time here. So we've got Augur coming up next, which I don't understand, but it's, according to the buzzwords on the front page, it's decentralized open source prediction market application platform. It's based on the Bitcoin protocol. So it's some way of getting consensus and understanding consensus based on the Bitcoin protocol. I may be misremembering, though, but we'll get that figured out next week, because that's what the show is. We've got coming up after that Free Switch, which is a telephony platform. Sounds pretty interesting. We've got the name I couldn't pronounce at the beginning of the show. I'm here. I'm not pronouncing it again. Rachel Romulidis, who is on the OSCON steering committee and will be talking to us about what's happening in OSCON this year, because we're going to be there 2 weeks later. And we're going to get some live guests there because they're much better than dead guests. So we're going to get a live guest there to come on the show and hopefully make a breakthrough announcement. We've also got Digicam, which is advanced digital photo management. Think things like iPhoto for Macs, and I'm sure there's Linux equivalents as well. Just added to the list, we've got Talkie, talkie.io, if you want to get a preview of that. That is an open source video chat and screen sharing and file sharing and all sorts of things application. In fact, if it works out really well, we may actually use Talkie for at least some segment of that show. I always say that, and then it always blows up in my face, but we'll try that. Gambas, which is a free object-oriented BASIC inspired by Visual Basic, inspired by but not anywhere derivative of the original code. We've got Ichinga, which is a fork of Nagios. That's a network monitoring system, and Ichinga is the heir apparent because Nagios is still live and kicking there, but I think you'll want to take a look at Ichinga when you get a chance. We've moved the Dart show. We moved the Dart show because originally I wasn't scheduled to be on that show, and I'm really into Dart, so we moved it down a little bit later, and in place of the two founders, we've actually got Casper Lund, one of the founders, and Anders Sandholm, which is the project leader within Google, who can talk more about present future of Dart. So that's going to be really awesome. Still filling in some stuff on Q3, I guess it is. Find out how we're doing with that. The big spreadsheet is linked from twit.tv/floss, which is the homepage for the show. Again, if you have somebody that's not on that list, please have the project manager email me, merlin@stonehenge.com, and I will put them on the short list for getting on the show. We do a live stream. We took some questions from that at 8 p.m. Not 8 p.m. I wish 8 p.m. 8 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays at live.twit.tv. That's a UTC 7 currently. It'll be UTC minus 8 coming up in winter. You can follow us on Floss Weekly on Google Plus, and those are tweeted automatically at Floss Weekly if you prefer Twitter. You can follow me on Google Plus at Randall L. Schwartz. Again, that is tweeted automatically over on at Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, on Twitter. I will be in FISLE in July, which is the big open source conference in Porto Alegre, Brazil. 5,000 attendees, mostly speaking Portuguese. My Portuguese is very poquito, not very much. I think actually that's the Spanish word. I think the Portuguese word's not poquito. But anyway, that's what I have to make up when I go down there. But I get to speak in English. I'm speaking on Dart, doing an hour-long introduction on Dart, which is the reason I want to have the Dart guys on directly. I'm also going to be at OSCON in July, mid-July, late July. So if you're at OSCON, please come up and say hi to me, and we will hook up, and I'll be doing a live show from there. So that's the end of that. Guillermo, what do you want to plug today?
I guess people can either Google don't Google me, but okay, it's fine. Don't Google me. You can not Google me, but you can Google me. It's at Gamerol on Twitter. I have a YouTube channel where I'm posting different projects now. And I guess that's it.
Cool. Well, that was simple. All right.
Yeah.
Well, just a little bit over time, so I want to make sure we get all wrapped up. And thank you, Guillermo, for jumping in on this show, because your hardware answers are hardware questions are always appreciated, because that's my weak area.
Yeah, no problem, man. I'm always here.
Right. Very, very good. Well, that's all we have time for. So we'll see you again next week on Floss Weekly.